of Shir HaShirim. Is that correct? 6 or 7? I don't know. I'm going to assume my sheet is right and it's week 6. Until somebody tells me otherwise. We are still working through the national approach to Shir HaShirim. The idea that it's the relationship between Hashem and the Jewish people, which we've expressed as Rashi's view, because Rashi not only proposes the idea, which, you know, we know is anchored in the Medrash in Shir HaShirim Rabbah, but he also takes you through the entire book, reading the book that way, giving us a full narrative from the time the Jews are in Egypt all the way through the Jews' entry into Galus, into exile under the Romans, the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple. So what I wanted to do today is to show you how some others have used that view. I want to show you Ibn Ezra, who is almost on the same page as Rashi. I want to show you the Rambam using it, which is very interesting, because people usually talk about the Rambam reading Shir HaShirim differently, so we're going to have to talk about that. And then I want to get into a modern application of this national read, which I was going to hold until, you know, when we're ready to pretty much wrap up Shir HaShirim, but then I realized it really fits better here. And that is the read of Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik as he makes use of Shir HaShirim, and specifically chapter 5 in his work Kol Dodi Dofeik. So if we get through Ibn Ezra, Rambam, and Rav Soloveitchik, then we're going to start on the other view, the other main view, which is that Shir HaShirim is actually personal. It's about the relationship between God and the individual, which is the other major view that we're going to see. That's the one that people usually associate with the Rambam, and there's more to be said about that, but when we get there. So, first we start with Ibn Ezra. Right? Everyone hears me all right, despite the whole noise? We're good? Okay. So, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, as I said, is almost on the same page as Rashi, meaning he believes it's the story of Jewish history. Somebody asked last time, though, I think it might have been Sandra, Rashi starts our history in Egypt, but our history goes back before Egypt. What happened to the Avos and Imahos, the patriarchs and matriarchs? So take a look, please, at source number 1, which comes from Ibn Ezra's introduction to Shir HaShirim. He says, Ubo sod sasum v'chasum. In it, in Shir HaShirim, is a secret that is closed and sealed. Ki hechel mimei Avraham Avinu ad Yemos HaMashiach. Starting in the time of Avraham and going until, hang on one second, I'm just muting because I'm getting background noise. Starting in the time of Avram Avinu and going all the way till the time of Mashiach, that's this book. V'chein kasa b'shiras ha'azinu, as we find in the song of Ha'azinu, right, towards the end of the Chumash, b'hanchel elyon goyim, from the time that the highest one, as I translated it here, assigned to, it should say nations, not nation, that's a spell check miss, when Hashem assigned different lands to different nations. Hechel min hador ha-palaga, starting from the generation of the dispersion when people were scattered. Ad shuv yisrael me'agalus achar milchemes Gog u'Magog, until Israel returns from the exile after the war of Gog and Magog. So it is the full panoply of history, beginning to end. So that's the first thing I wanted to note in Shir HaShirim, is that it's about Jewish history, world history, writ large. Second, he says that, yes, it is in that part. Second, he says that you shouldn't be surprised that Hashem compares his relationship with us to a love relationship between human beings. And this is something we've talked about before, but I just wanted to show you Ibn Ezra's view of it. He says, Ve'al tisma, still in source number 1, Ve'al tisma ba'avur shehim shil knesset Yisrael lakala v'hamakom doda. Don't be surprised that the text compares Israel to a bride and compares Hashem, the makom, to her beloved. Ki chein derech ha-neviyim, because that's what prophets do. And he says, Yeshaya did it, Yechezkel did it, Hosea did it, Tehillim did it. He calls it Tehillot, but that's the sefer that we are familiar with as Tehillim. And he says, and I quoted this next part in the introduction to Shir HaShirim, V'chalila chalila liyos Shir HaShirim b'divrei cheshek ki'im al derech mashal. He says, God forbid, Shir HaShirim is not a romance. It's simply an allegory. That's what this is. So he says, it's a story of the history of the relationship between Hashem and the Jewish people expressed as a human love relationship. And it's coming from Shlomo. And just like Rashi said, Shlomo saw this prophetically. That's what Ibn Ezra says. If you take a look at source number 2, the English begins with another one of those things that spell check isn't going to catch. Spell check knows that the word sign is a word, just as much as since is a word. So, ve'achar she'he'ida pasuk, era hamakom l'shlomo pa'amayim, since the text, and I gave you the reference in Malachim, says that Hashem speaks to Shlomo at least twice. Matema yesh boshin is nabe, she is nabe al dvarasid, ki beruach hakodesh diber se'a sefer. It shouldn't be surprising that Shlomo could write a book that reflects the future of Jewish history. Shlomo has access. We had a big discussion when we learned Malachim last year about whether Shlomo actually had prophecy or only divine inspiration. Were his visions his own or from Achia HaShiloni, the prophet, conveying them to him? But Ibn Ezra is of the view that Shlomo has this level of prophecy, and that's how he's able to provide us a vision of the future in Shir HaShirim. And he says the same thing is true for Asaf and for Haman, who are authors in Tehillim. He says, Shechibru Shiros Beruach HaKodesh, Nikru Nevi'im V'chozim. They compose poems with divine inspiration. They were called prophets and seers, and so it is with Shlomo. So he's very much like Rashi in his approach. But aside from the fact that he starts the story with Abraham, there are a couple of differences that are worth noting. Number one, his approach to writing his commentary and explaining it. He will not use Midrash in the way that Rashi does. What he does do, which is very interesting, but I'm not going to spend time on it, is that he offers a multi-layer reading. Remember, we saw in Rashi the way that in Rashi he offers us sometimes, here's the literal read, and then here is the Medrash read. Ibn Ezra also has layers in his commentary, but I didn't want to go through all of the layers. Okay. I see the note, Jonathan, but I'm not going there right now. It's a good philosophical question, but I just want to teach Shir HaShirim as a text. But the question of God's defense of the Jewish people in our day is an interesting one and worthy of discussion, just not right now. The second aspect of difference between Ibn Ezra's approach and Rashi's, one was his use of Medrash, and we noted that he starts from, well, let me actually go there. He starts from Abraham, like we said. So I'm giving you an example, first of all, of how he starts from Abraham. If you take a look at source number 3, the second sentence in Shir HaShirim, Yishakeni minishikos pihu. Right? Remember the pasuk? Yishakeni minishikos pihu. The Ra'aya, who represents the Jews, says of God that he should kiss us with the kisses of his mouth. And we saw in the Medrash, the way that they associated that with Har Sinai, with Mount Sinai, we saw that Rashi associated it with Hashem taking the Jews out of Egypt. Well, if you take a look in number 3, you see what Ibn Ezra does. He says, Hechel me Avraham. It actually starts from Avraham, Shehu ha'ikar. He is the essence, he is the main beginning. Unishikos ha'peh. Hema Torah v'hamitzvos. The kisses of the mouth are the Torah and mitzvos, meaning Hashem gives Avram Torah and mitzvos. Those are nishikos pihu. And this is a familiar idea, whether people like the idea or not, understand the idea or not. It's the idea that Avraham observes all of the mitzvos. Where does that come from? He gives you the pasuk. It's the beginning of Parshas Toldos. It will be not this week's Parsha, but the following week's Parsha. When the Torah says, Ekev asher shema Avraham bekoli, Hashem says, because Avraham listened to my voice, vayishmor mishmarti, he guarded my preserves, mitzvosai, chukosai, v'sarosai, my mitzvos, my statutes, my Torot. So that is understood in the Gemara and Yuma to say that that Abraham observed all of the mitzvahs. My point is not to get into a discussion about how Abraham observed all of the mitzvahs and what about the Rabbanans and so on. Those are fun discussions. My point is simply to say that Ibn Ezra says the kisses of Hashem's mouth are the mitzvahs that Hashem gives to Abraham. Not saving us in Egypt, not speaking to us at Har Sinai, but rather giving the mitzvahs to Abraham. So that's an example of Ibn Ezra starting the story with Abraham. Another element where he's different, and this is really the last point that I want to make about Ibn Ezra, and then I'll take comments. But just one other very interesting difference. You'll remember that when we read through the book initially, and I just gave you a basic outline of the book, we noticed that there were multiple times where Shir HaShirim makes reference to Benos Yerushalayim, the daughters of Jerusalem. So the Ra'aya says, I want you to swear, daughters of Jerusalem, that you will not awaken the love until it is time, or while God still desires us. There were different ways to translate that, but it makes reference to the daughters of Jerusalem. There's a passage where the Ra'aya speaks to the daughters of Jerusalem and describes her beloved, describes God. So who are these daughters of Jerusalem? If the Ra'aya is the Jews, who are the daughters of Jerusalem? So we saw Rashi say that the daughters of Jerusalem are the nations. And daughters means like suburbs. You find in Tanakh that cities that are around the major center are called Benot. So these are the daughters of Jerusalem. They're the nations becoming the suburbs of Jerusalem. We had a pasuk in Yechezkel to support that. Ibn Ezra says no. Ibn Ezra says the daughters of Jerusalem are actually in the mind of the Ra'aya. The Ra'aya is us. The beloved female is us. I'm just watching the transcript. It's very funny. The Rai is us. Okay. It'd be a good slogan for Levi's Rye Bread. The Rai is us. The Ra'aya is us. And the thoughts that we have in our own head, in our own sort of mental dialogue, those thoughts are the daughters of Jerusalem. The Ra'aya is talking to herself. That's Ibn Ezra's read. Take a look at source number 4. He says, Vida, you should know, ki benos Yerushalayim, this idea that there are daughters of Jerusalem, hishtab shubo anashim rabin. Lots of people have been really confused about this. Achar shekneses Yisrael, hi hamedaberes, ma'inyan benos Yerushalayim. If the Jews are the ones speaking, who are the daughters of Jerusalem? Yesh omrim ki shtayim heina. So some say there are two, meaning there are two Jews in this story. Achas bashamayim v'achas baretz tachteha kenegda. One is in the heavens and the other one is on the ground below. V'inyan benos Yerushalayim hamalachim shamala. The daughters of Jerusalem are the angels. I haven't actually seen the commentary that says that, but Ibn Ezra is familiar with a commentary that says that. V'acherim amru, and others say, shem umos ha'olam, that they're the nations of the world. And this is the approach that we saw in Rashi. Kitam v'nasati eshen lach labanos. And he quotes you that pasuk in Yechezkel, that Hashem says, I will make them, the nations, daughters of Israel. V'hanachon be'enai, but he says, you want to know what I think? Shamashal hu al isha medaberes im nafsha v'tashiv amareha la. I gave you the reference in Shoftim that he's playing off of there. From Devorah's song. He says, this is a parable about a woman who is talking to herself and responding with her own statements. So she is having an internal conversation, and her interlocutor, that to whom she's imagining herself speaking, are the daughters of Jerusalem. Kilu tamar in machshavoseha. Right? As though conversing with her own thoughts. Vehin, benos Yerushalayim. These are the daughters of Jerusalem. That's how he reads Shir HaShirim. There is no third player in this story. The nations are not involved in this. It's the Ra'aya's own thoughts. It makes for a very interesting read, obviously, of the, of the book, and would require application to the book. But I don't want to spend the whole time going through Ibn Ezra's layers, because Ibn Ezra's layers are really confusing. Anybody who thought that it was confused with Rashi, you ain't seen nothing. Go with Ibn Ezra, you get really confused. He has three different layers. Okay, comments and questions on Ibn Ezra's approach. That means it was all really clear or all really unclear. Could be either way. I'll go ask the daughters of Jerusalem. Okay, so that was Ibn Ezra. And then the Rambam. The Rambam also uses this read, and it's really funny, funny to me anyway, because the Rambam is known for reading Shir HaShirim as being about the soul and God. And we're going to talk about that, as I said, in our series once we finish the national level. However, the Rambam also made use of the national read in his Igeret Teman, his letter to the Jews of Yemen. He was dealing with the problem of false messianism in 12th century Yemen. And it's a broader thing and not really a topic that I can speak on, knowledgeably. But look at what he does in his letter. Source number 5, Hebrew at the bottom of one side, English is at the top of the other. He says, Ushlomo hamelach alav shalom, dima osanu leisha yafa betachlis hayofi she'en bayofi, she'en badofi. He says, Shlomo compared us, the Jews, to a beautiful woman at the height of beauty, no flaw. Shenemar, like the Pasuk says, Kulach yafa ra'yasi umum ein bach. You are entirely beautiful, my beloved. There is no blemish in you. V'dima sha'ar ha'emunos v'asfaros sherotzim lamshicha lehem alachzira le'emunasam ke'anshei ha'belial hashtufim b'zima. And Shlomo compared these other beliefs, these other ideas that the nations try to draw us to, compare them to wicked people who are immoral, v'hamefatim hanashim, and they try to seduce the women, shehin benos chayil, who are women of substance, good women, lahasig mehen ta'avasam ha'mechuares, to try to get their ugly desires from them. So the Jews are the beautiful ra'ayah. The nations are trying to draw them away from God. Kain ira lanuim elu shehim masiim or mas. Yeah, I think it's masiim osanu umefatim lahachazirenu ledaso sehem. He says that's what happened to us. They tried to draw us to their religions. Veulai neachez venistabech v'sivchei pachazusam uveanfei shikrehem, in the hope that we would get caught up in their lies. They want to get us into their idolatry. V'achar kach, second paragraph, V'achar kach chazar b'chochmaso b'lashon tshuvas ha'uma. But then Shlomo provides the answer of the nation to them. Ki'lu hi omeres la'osam shem rotzim l'fat hosa, as though the nation is saying to those who want to seduce her, u'laharos lehem shesvarasam u'ulam misvarasam, to show them her approach is greater than theirs. La'ezat davar mischazkin bi. What exactly is it that you want to draw me to? Hatuchlu laharosli kemo macholas hamachanayim. Are you able to show me something like mecholat hamachanayim? Machol, a dance. Like the dance in the camps. What does that mean? Klomar shahumat titon kinegdam vomeres lahem haruni kemo mamad har sinai shayabo machanei elokim machanei Yisrael zelu madzeh. Show me something that is the equivalent of what happened when we stood at Sinai. We had the camp of God and the camp of the Jews. You had that was a glorious moment. Show me something like that as a shublat haschem. Then fine, then I'll consider what you're talking about. Our response to them is to say, here is the glory of God. What do you have that rivals it? Now, again, the Rambam here is not going to provide a line-by-line read of Shir HaShirim in this mode. The Rambam is using Shir HaShirim to make a particular point. His point is to the Jews in Yemen that nations trying to draw us away from Judaism are a very old thing. It's already predicted in Tanakh. You can see it in Shir HaShirim. And we have always refused their overtures. We've always said, what they're offering us is not the equal of what we already have. So that's what he's borrowing Shir HaShirim for. He's not going to go into it at length. He's not going to give us a verse by verse. He's just borrowing Shir HaShirim to make that point. You follow? So again, this is all under the heading of reading Shir HaShirim as the story of the Jews as a nation in our relationship with Hashem. We saw the Medrash in Shir HaShirim Rabbah do it in its very pure way. Everything is very positive, not as a historical narrative, not as a starting here and ending there, but just overall it's about the national love. We saw Rashi show it as a book-long narrative. We saw Ibn Ezra read it as a book-long narrative, just changing a little bit the beginning point of it. And we saw the Rambam use it as well. I see the note in the chat in which Dahlia asks about whether this is, the reference to the daughters of Jerusalem being the non-Jews has anything to do with Shlomo marrying women from different nations. So the commentators that I've seen on it don't go that route. It's an interesting thought. They prefer the route that's anchored in the Pasuk in Yechezkel and other psukim that banot could be suburbs. That's the one that they keep on bringing. I haven't seen them make a reference to that, but it's an interesting thought for sure. Ricky.
So far, I like Rashi's interpretation the best. It's the most consistent throughout the whole Shir HaShirim, and it shows it in a different light, and I like that. It makes the most sense, and it's the most endearing to.
I hear you, but keep in mind, I haven't shown you Ibn Ezra beginning to end, so it's not something
so
you can assess. Right, but I just know that we're not going to be going through it, but there's an awful lot there that's worth seeing. Janine.
I just want to look up the not usual line in Shir HaShirim because in a way, Ibn Ezra makes the most sense to me because our thoughts are not always the same. Sometimes we feel one way, sometimes another. And there's such opposing, what the not usual lines say or do doesn't make sense. And some people say they're two different characters, and that's harder for me to believe, doesn't resonate with me as much as the fact that it's our thoughts, which could change from time to time, our perspectives,
right.
Our thoughts, we're not always on the same wavelength.
Right. I mean, the big question for me, which I didn't look up, and I really should, it's not hard to, is what does Ibn Ezra do with the Shomrim in the city? In other words, it's not as though if you get rid of the Benos Yerushalayim, then it's just God and the Jews. There, you have this other set of figures, the Shomrim, the guardians of the city who encounter me and who beat me up and so on. So who are those? You know, and I it's simple. I just have to look it up in Ibn Ezra, and maybe in the beginning of the next year I will come back to it. But is he really trying to just make the book entirely God and the Jews? Or is it just that he really finds that Benos Yerushalayim, in terms of the way they show up in the book, fit as the thoughts of the Jews? And there could also theoretically be a third figure in the book anyway, who is separate.
But when we said that they're a separate figure, I think we had to say sometimes they mean this. I think a week or two ago we discussed that, and sometimes they mean the other nations, and sometimes they, I forget what it was, but there were two very different...
Yeah. No, we saw that in Rashi.
I found that hard to believe because it's the same word, hard to understand, because the not Yerushalayim doesn't mean one or does it mean the other? Does it mean both?
Right.
When they're not the same.
Right, except that when you look at the Medrash in Shir HaShirim Rabbah, it has no problem with that idea of giving one explanation here and one explanation somewhere else. Like, you will find competing Midrashim, and they're good with that. It doesn't have to be consistent, but I agree with you. Someone like a Rashi, we expect to be consistent. Ibn Ezra, we expect to be consistent. That, although it doesn't always work that way. Chana.
The Shomrim always seem to me obstacles or sins, because in the Shomrim Laboker, Al mentions Al Chataim.
Right. No, it's... the question of how to take the Shomrim is one that we're going to come back to, not immediately. Sorry? I missed you.
Okay.
No, I didn't hear you because I was trying to open my Ibn Ezra on the computer while you were talking there, but it just slowed my computer down, so I missed what you were saying.
To me, it seems like the shomrim are the chataim, the saints, or the obstacles, because they always do something bad. They're against us. They are downfalls.
Right.
They take away my crown. They do this. They
right. Well, you know, let me try to share the Ibn Ezra, and we can look at it together. Just have to move this so it's not in the way. So Ibn Ezra and Shir Hashirim Gimel 3:3 has a reference to the Shomrim. So I'm opening up Ibn Ezra here. You should be able to see it on your screen. Interesting. He doesn't have any comment on them at all here. He has no comment here on the Shomrim. Oh, wait, there he goes. Yeah, Shomrim. So the problem is he's doing it in his layers. That's in his palm shli sheets. He has three different layers that he uses when he goes through it. And in the third layer, it's Moshe Aharon, which was what we saw in Rashi, you may remember. All right, I'm going to have to go through it separately rather than try to do this on the fly and see what I can come up with. Okay. Other thoughts on these uses of it before we get to Rav Soloveitchik? It's really funny to me to see the Rambam take this, because like I said, it's not his main view of Shir HaShirim, but he's very clearly able to see this other view as well. So, Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik interprets chapter 5 of Shir HaShirim as God's call to the Jewish people, as a homiletic, meaning what he's doing, what we're going to see him do, is not a Tanakh Shir. He's not reading through the entire book of Shir HaShirim, beginning to end. And he doesn't feel like this is the only way to read Shir HaShirim. When we do the individual approach, the idea that Shir HaShirim is the individual talking to God, or God talking to the individual, we're going to see Rav Soloveitchik make use of that approach to the book, the drama between the individual and Hashem. He's going to make use of that approach. He's going to write explicitly, we'll see it in a moment, that both approaches speak to Hashem's relationship with the world. One is in terms of the special relationship with Klal Yisrael, with the Jews, and the other in terms of Hashem's relationship with individuals. Take a look on your sheet, please. It's source number 6, and you'll see what I mean. This is from Rav Soloveitchik's work, Ubikashtem Misham. Ubikashtem Misham, those words come from the book of Devarim, the description of the Jews in exile seeking God. Ubikashtem Misham es Hashem Elokecha. You will seek from there. It's published in my edition as part of Ish HaHalacha, Halachic Man. So, in his first footnote, he makes reference to the two layers of Shir HaShirim, the national and the personal. And he says they're both legit. La'amito shel davar, in truth, shnei pirushim le'inyan echad niskavnu. Both approaches are seeking the same thing. Le'yachas sheben HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'ha'olam, the relationship between Hashem and the world. Baram, however, Zikat zu mitgalemet beino levein hayachid, vegam beino levein hatzibur. This bond that Hashem has, this link Hashem has, exists between Hashem and individuals, and between Hashem and the nation. Kishem shah elokam misgageil hisdabek biachid, just as God longs to stick to the individual, kahu misavel hasmich chinaso betzibur miyuchad, so too, he wants his Shechina to be continuously in a particular community. B'tzibur nivchar, a chosen community. U'b'umah miyuchedes, a special nation. Hametichut hi du partzufit. He says the tension is of two faces. Universalit al historit ul'umit historit. Universal and above history, as well as national historical. Which if that was a lot of big words at the end of the sentence, don't worry about it, because he basically said everything he needed to say before that. No, but what he's saying is, it's the relationship Hashem has with the Jews and the relationship Hashem has with each individual. Both are legitimate aspects and both are true. And therefore, you don't take Shir HaShirim as only being about one or only being about the other. You follow? He says there are, you have both reads. And what Rav Soloveitchik does with this is really a drasha. A drasha not in the technical sense of midrash. A drasha in the sense of Shabbos Shuva drasha. Shabbos HaGadol drasha. That's what this is. This is a drasha. He's giving a speech. Aside from Rav Soloveitchik's status as, you know, a brilliant scholar of Gemara, and as a posek of Halacha, he was very much a philosopher. He taught philosophy at YU in his early years there. And he was also a darshan. He was an orator, teaching philosophical and moral lessons from the Torah. And what he's doing here is what darshanim have always done. He's making use of the text of Shir HaShirim, and particularly, specifically, the fifth chapter, to serve a broad philosophical slash theological point. So don't take what he's doing here, hang on, Ricky. Don't take what Rav Soloveitchik is doing here as a guide to Shir HaShirim. It's not. Shir HaShirim is a tool that he is using in order to make a point. So don't look for, and you'll see as I go through it, what I'm trying to tell you, you'll see very clearly. Don't try to like tie in things he's saying to this verse or that verse. He's making use of the idea that Shir HaShirim is a metaphor for the dynamic between Hashem and the Jews, and he is going to make use of it in a way I'm going to show you shortly. Ricky.
I did understand the term that he used for the other functionaries that he taught, and he was also
A darshan. A darshan is somebody who gives homiletic speeches.
In English, it's an orator.
Yeah, but no darshan was ever an orator, and no orator was ever a darshan.
What kind of speeches? I didn't understand the word you said.
Rose, I need you to mute.
I think she doesn't understand the word homiletic. That's a word that everyone's familiar with.
Right. No, that I understand. But I'm struggling to come up with a good English term for a darshan. A darshan is not an orator. I'm muting people because I'm getting a lot of background noise.
It's almost an interpreter.
Moshe writes preacher. And maybe that's a good approach to it. It's somebody whose role is not only to teach, but to inspire and to lead. Rose, I need you to ask you to not unmute because you have background noise.
No, I'm unmute. You want me to unmute?
No, I want you to stay muted, please. I'm sorry.
Okay.
There's background noise. Thank you. The darshan is trying to inspire and lead and guide people to raise their emotions, to direct them to a particular set of practical steps. That's what Rav Soloveitchik is doing here, as he did quite frequently in drasha. See, people sometimes forget he was a shul rabbi for quite a few years. So what we're talking about here is an essay that was originally a drasha, was originally a speech, called Kol Dodi Dofek. Literally, the voice of my beloved knocks, which of course was what we saw in chapter 5 of Shir HaShirim, the image of the Jewish people lying in bed after they've already bathed and gotten ready for bed, and Hashem comes knocking at the door, and they say, ach, I've already taken off my cloak, I already washed, I can't get up. And then Dode puts his hand through the door, and they say, ach, I'm so moved, I have to get up. And they get up, and they go looking, and the Dode is already gone.
Must have been great.
So the idea is that this is, in anyone's read of Shir HaShirim, about when Hashem comes to us and we fail to respond. And that was true in Rashi's read, and it's true in Ibn Ezra's read, and it's true in Soloveitchik's read. But Rav Soloveitchik's read gives it a modern application. Take a look, please, at source number 7. This is from an essay that appeared in YU's To Go, Yom Ha'atzmaut To Go, about 5 years ago. Rabbi Karmi teaches philosophy at YU, which is an understatement. He is like not just a teacher of philosophy. There's a lot more to be said about that. But Rabbi Karmi was the editor of Tradition for many, many years. I very much enjoy his writing, although I was never in a class with him. If you take a look at number 7, this is from the beginning of his article about Kol Dodi Dofek, and I gave you the link so you could read the full article. He said, during his many years as honorary president of the American Mizrahi, Rav Soloveitchik delivered many addresses articulating his conception of religious Zionism. Several of his Yiddish speeches were transcribed and published in Yiddish, along with Hebrew and English translations of varying quality. Kol Dodi Dofek, literally the voice of my beloved Knox, delivered on Yom Ha'atzmaut 1956, is his most ambitious statement, and the only one that he later prepared for print in Hebrew. There are 2 translations, at least, that I know of, into English. Bearing in mind how little the Rav published in those years, the pains he took over Kol Dodi Dofek testify to the importance of the essay and its message. It was quickly adopted as part of the Israeli school curriculum in Jewish thought. In truth, Kol Dodi Dofek is much more than a Zionist speech. It formulates a fundamental outlook on the nature of history and Jewish peoplehood. The ideas are of great importance, and the structure is also significant, and you can read his essay to see more about it, or you can just read Kol Dodi Dofek, because in source number 8, I gave you links to 2 very good resources. Number 1, the Sfaria website has the David Z. Gordon translation of Kol Dodi Dofek, and that's what I used for the pieces that I brought starting in source number 9, just because I could cut and paste it. The other translation that I use is Fate and Destiny by Professor Lawrence Kaplan. It's very good. It's just not available to be cut and pasted. Otherwise, I would have probably gone with that one because that's the one I'm more familiar with. But in any case, you can click on that Sfaria link and you can get the text of Kol Dodi Dofek, both the Hebrew edition that Rav Soloveitchik prepared and the Gordon translation. And then the other is that in 2006, the journal Tradition published articles about Kol Dodi Dofek 50 years later. So you could see the, you could see how people think about it at this point. But this is an essay that makes use of that passage from the 5th chapter in Shir HaShirim. I'm going to give you a basic outline of the essay as a whole, and then we're going to see the part that relates to chapter 5. Okay? We clear so far? I'll pause for a second. Okay. So, the essay begins by saying that there are 2 outlooks on the human experience. There is the outlook that is called in Hebrew, goral, or fate, and the outlook that is called in Hebrew, yi'ud, or destiny. Right? That's where the Kaplan edition gets its title, Fate and Destiny. Goral, fate, means I experience whatever I experience because of incomprehensible events that are bigger than me, and my role in this world is just roll with the punches. Endure it. It's the way it goes. That's one way that people look at their experiences. That's the fate approach. The other approach, the destiny approach, is to say, I choose how to react to events. And whatever happens to me, good or bad, is meant to lead to my response. I have a role to play. I'm not just an ant who happens to be walking along and there's sun or there's rain and then whatever it is, and it has nothing to do with me except that it's something I need to deal with. Anything that happens to me is meant to generate a response from me, and my response has significance. You see the difference between the two. So that's how he begins the essay. And he says, first he goes into this whole thing about Eov, which is a topic for another time. I'm very much not a fan of the way he uses Eof in this drasha. Then he talks about our delay in responding to God when our destiny knocks. The fact that we have a bad track record for responding when Hashem knocks at the door. And then he identifies six ways in which Hashem knocked on the door with the formation of the state of Israel and the events around it. Then he goes on from there to discuss our obligation to respond to the knocks, our obligation to take part in the building up of the state of Israel, our national covenant, our sense of being part of a nation, fate and destiny for individuals and on the national level. He goes on. There's a lot more in the essay, but the most famous part is the part that gives the essay its name, Kol Dodi Dofek. So if you take a look at source number 9, I brought you excerpts for each of the six knocks. The first knock, he says, is the United Nations vote. The fact that the UN voted to recognize the state of Israel. He says first, and again, this is a Gordon translation. The Hebrew is great. For those who are Hebrew readers, you really should look it up. First, the knock of the beloved was heard in the political arena. From the point of view of international relations, no one will deny that the rebirth of the state of Israel in a political sense was an almost supernatural occurrence. Both Russia and the Western nations supported the establishment of the state of Israel. Remember, he's writing this in 1956. Right? You think of what's going on, you know, in communist Russia, Hungary, and so on. At this point, he says, the Russians and the Western nations are both on board. This was perhaps the one resolution on which East and West concurred during the Cold War era. I assume that during the Cold War era line is Gordon's insertion later. Rusalovichik would not have used that phrase in 1956. I have to look back at my Hebrew copy, but I'm fairly sure of that one. I am inclined to believe that the United Nations was especially created for this end, for the sake of fulfilling the mission that divine providence had placed upon it. It appears to me that one cannot point to any other concrete accomplishment on the part of the United Nations, written in 1956, still true in 2022. Our rabbis of blessed memory already expressed this view. At times rain falls on account of one individual and for one blade of grass. Medrash and Bereishis Rabbah. I do not know who the representatives of the press with their human eyes saw to be the chairman in that fateful session of the General Assembly in which the creation of the State of Israel was decided. But he who looked carefully with his spiritual eyes saw the true chairman, capital C, who conducted the proceedings, the beloved. He knocked with his gavel on the lectern. That's knock number one, the fact that the UN approved the founding of the state. Knock number two is the War of Independence. Second, the knock of the beloved, this is source number 10, was heard on the battlefield. The tiny defense forces of the State of Israel defeated the mighty Arab armies. The miracle of the many delivered into the hands of the few materialized before our eyes, and an even greater miracle happened. God hardened the heart of Yishmael and commanded him to go into battle against the State of Israel. Had the Arabs not declared war on Israel, and instead supported the partition plan, the State of Israel would have remained without Jerusalem, without a major portion of the Galil, without some areas of the Negev. If thousands of years ago, Pharaoh had allowed the children of Israel to leave immediately as Moses had originally requested, Moses would have been bound by his word to return in 3 days. Pharaoh, however, hardened his heart and did not listen to Moses. So he says, not just the victory in the war, but the fact that the war happened at all, is God manipulating things and sending a message. Then you get number 11, knock number 3. And that is, we talked about this already with Origen, the issue of Christian supersessionism, the idea that they see in Shir HaShirim a story of God choosing the church over the Jews. So Rav Soloveitchik here sounds a theme that I've heard in many of his speeches. Third, the beloved also began to knock on the door of the tent of theology. And possibly this is the strongest beckoning, the strongest of the knocks. I have on several occasions emphasized in my remarks concerning the land of Israel that the theological arguments of Christian theologians to the effect that the Holy One has taken away from the community of Israel its rights to the land of Israel, that all the biblical promises relating to Tzion and Yerushalayim now refer in an allegorical sense to Christianity and the Christian Church, were all publicly shown to be false, baseless contentions by the establishment of the State of Israel. One must have a broad familiarity with theological literature from the time of Justin Martyr down to the theologians of our own day to comprehend the full extent of this marvel by which the central axiom of Christian theology was shattered. And here he says something which some of you may be familiar with. I am not. I looked it up online. I couldn't find it. About Alan Dulles. We should pay careful attention to the full extent of this, to the learned explanation of our Secretary of State, Mr. Dulles, who served as the deacon of an Episcopalian church, to a committee of the United States Senate, that the Arabs hate the Jews because they killed the founder of their religion. Right? Of course, it's not the founder of their religion, it's the founder of his religion. This, quote, explanation possesses hidden and deep symbolic significance. I am not a psychiatrist, surely not a psychoanalyst, but I know how to study Talmud, and I remember well what our rabbis of blessed memory said about Bilam. From his blessings you may learn what was in his heart. Sometimes when a person speaks too much, something of the truth slips out. When one of the senators asked the Secretary of State, why do the Arabs hate the Jews, he really wanted to answer, personally, I too, as a Christian, have no great love for them because they killed our Messiah and consequently forfeited their portion of Abraham's heritage. So in other words, Dulles wanted to express Christian frustration with this founding of the state, and he ended up accidentally saying it when he was asked about the Arabs. He goes on to say, I find satisfaction in reading about the State of Israel in the Catholic and Protestant newspapers. Despite themselves, they must mention the name of Israel when they report the news of Tzion and Yerushalayim, which we possess. I always have a special sense of satisfaction when I read in the paper that Israel's reaction is not as yet known because today is Saturday and government offices are closed. Or when I read on the eve of Passover an item from the United Press that Jews will sit down tonight to the Seder table in the hope that the miracles of Egypt will return and recur today. Listen, my beloved Knox. That's number three. Number four, stemming the tide of assimilation. Fourth, the beloved Knox in the heart of the youth, which is assimilated and perplexed. The period of hester panim, in which God's face is not visible, in the 1940s, brought confusion among the Jewish masses and especially Jewish youth. Assimilation increased, and the urge to flee from Judaism and the Jewish people reached its apex. Fear, despair, and ignorance caused many to forsake the Jewish community and, quote, climb aboard the ship, to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord, borrowing from Jonah. Just as Jonah sought to flee God's presence, a seemingly unstoppable tidal wave stood over us and threatened to destroy us. Suddenly, the Beloved began to beckon to the hearts of the perplexed, and his beckoning, the establishment of the State of Israel, at least slowed the process of flight. Many who were once alienated are now bound to the Jewish state with ties of pride in its mighty accomplishments. Many American Jews who were partially assimilated find themselves beset by hidden fear and concern for any crisis that the State of Israel is at the time passing through. They pray for its well-being and welfare, even though they are far from being totally committed to it. Even Jews who are hostile to the State of Israel must defend themselves from the strange charge of dual loyalty and proclaim daily and declare that they have no stake in the Holy Land. It is good for a Jew when he cannot ignore his Jewishness and is obligated to perpetually answer the questions, who are you and what is your occupation? The questions that they asked Jonah on the boat. Even when extraordinary fear grips him and he doesn't have the strength or fortitude to answer with true pride, I am a Jew and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven. The unrelenting question of who are you ties him to the Jewish people. That's number four. Then knock number five. I could have just done this as an outline and listed to you the six, but really that would not have done it justice. So take a look at knock number five. This is one that resonates with a lot of people. Jewish blood is not hefker. This is one of the things I have against the translation. The word hefker is a technical term. It means for something to be ownerless. It really means something that has been abandoned, has not been claimed at all. They translated it here as cheap in the essay, and that's a mistake. as you'll see in the line. He says, the fifth knock of the beloved is perhaps the most important. For the first time in the annals of our exile, divine providence has amazed our enemies with the astounding discovery that Jewish blood is not hefker, right? It's not abandoned. If the anti-Semites describe this phenomenon as being an eye for an eye, we will agree with them. If we want to courageously defend our continued national and historical existence, we must from time to time interpret the verse of an eye for an eye literally. So many eyes were lost in the course of our bitter exile because we did not repay hurt for hurt. The time has come for us to fulfill the simple meaning of an eye for an eye. Then he says, of course, I am sure everyone recognizes that I am an adherent of the oral law, and from my perspective, there is no doubt that the verse refers to monetary restitution as defined by halacha. He says, I'm not about to say that a Beis Din should be knocking out somebody's eye. However, with respect to the Mufti and Nasser, I would demand that we interpret the verse in accordance with its literal meaning, the taking of an actual eye. Pay no attention to the saccharine suggestions of known assimilationists and of some Jewish socialists who stand pat in their rebelliousness and think they are still living in Bialystok, Brest-Litovsk, and Minsk of the year 1905, and openly declare that revenge is forbidden to the Jewish people in any place, at any time, and under all circumstances. Havel Havalim, vanity of vanities, as the Gordon translation has it. Revenge is forbidden when it is pointless. But if one is aroused thereby to self-defense, it is the most elementary right of man to take his revenge. Self-defense is a different story, and he views striking back on behalf of the State of Israel as self-defense. That's his argument. Clear? And then the last one. I'll tell you the truth. I think the other five are stronger than the last one in terms of making his point, but it's still an important point, which is, the State of Israel and its availability as a place of refuge. The sixth beckoning, of which we should also not lose sight, was heard at the time of the opening of the gates of the land of Israel. A Jew escaping from an enemy's land now knows that he can find refuge in the land of his forefathers. This is a new phenomenon in the annals of our history. Up to now, when a Jewish population was uprooted, it wandered in the wilderness of the nations without finding shelter and habitation. The shutting of the gates in the face of the exiled caused total destruction for much of the Jewish people. Now the situation has changed. When any nation expels its Jewish minority, the exiled now direct their steps to Zion, and she as a compassionate mother absorbs them. We are all witnesses to the settlement of Oriental Jewry in Israel over the last several years. Who knows what would have been in store for these brothers of ours in the lands of their origin if not for the State of Israel, which brought them to her in planes and ships. Had Israel been born before the Hitlerian Holocaust, hundreds of thousands of Jews could have been saved from the gas chambers and the crematoria. The miracle of the state tarried somewhat, and in the wake of its delay, thousands and tens of thousands of Jews were taken to the slaughter. Now that the hour of Hester Panim has passed, however, the possibility exists for Jews who are pried from their homes to take root in the Holy Land. This should not be taken lightly. Listen, my beloved Knox. That's the sixth. First, I see the note in the chat, Rose. Rav Soloveitchik has no problem disagreeing with Elie Wiesel. That's not really an issue for him. But in terms of what he's doing here, he's taking chapter 5 as inspiration for his comments. We saw, when we read Rashi on chapter 5, we saw that there was a flow to Shir HaShirim. How, in the beginning of the book, there's a song from the Ra'aya, or the Dode, and they sing praises to each other, and they talk about their love to each other from Egypt, working their way forward. Then you saw in the book the journey to the land of Israel in chapter 2, chapter 3. And then you saw the praise of the Dod for the Ra'aya of God for the Jews in chapter 4, which Rashi associated with the period of the Mishkan in Shiloh. And then we got to chapter 5. And the Dod knocks for us and we fail to answer. And Rashi said that was talking about the first temple, the first Beis HaMikdash, when we sinned during the temple. We didn't listen to the knocking that was from the messages of the prophets, and the attacks of Aram, until it was finally too late. Rav Soloveitchik's point is that we dare not miss those knocks. That's what Rav Soloveitchik wants us to pay attention to. And so he uses reading Shir HaShirim on the national level as a way to make that point. Clear? Okay. So that takes us through the national level. The Medrash, Shira, Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Rambam's use of it, the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik. What we do now is switch gears. And I realize we only have 4 minutes, but we're going to start on the idea, and then we'll come back to it, God willing, next time. In this layer, we see the relationship between the Dod and the Raya as the relationship between God and individual. Hashem longing to be close to us, we long to be close to Hashem, dealing with various frustrations along the way. And, there's a challenge that comes with this personal approach, because it really personifies God, right? Even more than the national read. In other words, when you say it's God saying, I love the nation as a whole, God appears less human. But when you start to apply it to God's relationship with each of us individually, it really seems to assign emotions to God, and it makes the relationship with God more of a romance. And so Rav Soloveitchik makes the point that we read in our introduction, and I reproduced it here in source number 15, saying, don't read Shir HaShirim literally. And here he brings in eye for an eye in the other direction. I brought it for you in source number 15. We'll read through the English very quickly because we already read this in the beginning of the series. The description Holy of Holies, which the Mishnah and Yadayim uses for Shir HaShirim, refers to the divine symbolism described in it. It is Holy of Holies. But the description expresses a halachic principle. This Megillah was not meant to be explained according to its simple text, meaning don't get caught up in the love layer and read that as the literal. It's really not. It's about God's relationship. He says, in the entire Torah, we may explain verses according to their medrash or according to their pshat. You can go one way or the other. The pshat of the text is part of Torah. In Shir HaShirim, the pshat of the words is excluded from Torah, and its place is taken by medrash on the text. He says, there's no such thing as reading Shir HaShirim literally. That's how far he goes with it. The symbolic method of interpretation is the only one. Anyone who explains this Megillah according to the pshat of the text regarding sensual love desecrates its holiness and denies the spoken Torah. He's very concerned about people humanizing God in this regard. And he says, this is what the Rambam wrote in his introduction to the Mishnah. And I didn't bring you the full piece that we saw during the introduction, but if you flip the page to the end of the source, only the Medrash stands, the pshat of the words is entirely removed. Explaining texts like, and you shall cut off her hand, eye for an eye, pre-eats hadar, in their literal sense, is an act of cutting the saplings of tradition. He says, you're not supposed to read them literally, including that eye for an eye that he invoked above. When he was being a darshan, he could use it. He's not being a darshan, now he's more responsible to the text. So what we're going to do next time, God willing, is see how the Rambam reads this as a very human-sounding relationship. And what I want to do after that, probably part of next week's session, what we'll see, is to also see Ralbag and also see Malbim. And they take it on a philosophical level that's sort of along the same lines as what the Rambam does, somewhat different, as we'll see. And once we've done all of that, I think we'll shift towards modern reads and add a couple of notes. By the time we're done with all of that, you'll be ready for Mishlei, I think. Okay, thank you very much, everybody. And have a good rest of the week.
Thank you very much. It was excellent.